Welcome to EDUCAUSE Now. I'm Jerry Bain. The economic issues that are affecting higher ed IT are also giving CIOs and IT managers the opportunity to look at services and infrastructure through a new lens.
A new lens that allows those of us in higher ed IT to take a hard look at everything we do. From considering centralized versus decentralized IT, to managing the enterprise systems, to supporting teaching and learning. I'm Colleen Luckett. On this episode of EDUCAUSE Now, we'll hear from several CIOs about the unprecedented challenges and opportunities they now face, and how seizing the moment might just mean a rewrite of the IT playbook for higher ed.
I don't think you get many opportunities in your career to reinvent everything that you do and create an entirely new future. And I think this is one of those opportunities.
We'll also present excerpts from a discussion that took place at the EDUCAUSE Learning Initiative's 2009 annual meeting, which brought together leading thinkers in teaching and learning to discuss 21st century digital literacies.
So instead of just saying, oh, here's this Twitter, I don't know what Twitter is, Twitter's another thing, I can't learn Twitter, I'll never master Twitter, say, what human desire does this represent? Somebody thought that this would be interesting.
And a commentary from EDUCAUSE President Diana Oblinger on collaboration and the concept of a creation net.
If you're interested in finding out more about the stories and interviews you hear on the podcast, visit our show notes at www.educause.edu/now.
The ongoing economic issues facing higher education are forcing state, community, and private higher ed CIOs and IT administrators to rethink their service approaches. We've gathered several professionals from a variety of institutions to share their thoughts. Teresa Rowe is the CIO of Oakland University. She recently spoke to us at the Midwest Regional Conference, where she presented opening remarks at the Regional CIO Forum.
It's an extremely complex issue. We have constraining factors that are putting a lot of pressure on us. For example, states talking about or implementing tuition freezes for state institutions. We've seen economic impact for private institutions as they look at endowments that are shrinking or have shrunk significantly. We have a changing demographic that's putting pressure on all of us. Perhaps there aren't enough American families that value higher education right now. We get a lot of criticism in the market. So we have a lot of constraining factors.
We're in new territory in so many ways.
Carol Hall, CIO for the Eastern Iowa Community College District.
What we're seeing is an unprecedented situation with unemployment, the fiscal concerns, the demand, the aging baby boomer population, the retirement of faculty, the retirement of administrators, the aging of our workforce. We're seeing an unprecedented leadership opportunity.
People need to lead this.
Bruce Moss, CIO at the University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee.
The more leadership there is, the better. The leadership should come from every single quarter. There should be no limit, in my view, on where leadership comes from.
Certainly, we institutionally have every year during the budget process asked the question, what are we going to not be doing anymore, and getting those things off the plate. So I don't want to leave the impression that we haven't had those conversations.
Peggy Plimpton, Vice President for Finance and Administration at Lehigh University.
I think what this will give us anyway is an opportunity to create a whole structure around that conversation in a much more institution-wide way and in a much more coherent way, so that we can actually engage the entire university in some of those discussions.
There's a real realization to people right now as to what may have been important 6 months ago, certainly not as important today.
Kelly Block, Assistant Director of Application Portfolio Management at the University of Illinois Central Administration.
And that'll, I think, affect everything we're going to do for the next 18 or 24 months with respect to project selection, prioritization, and the resources we have to work with, which will certainly be less in some measure.
No one's proud of what they're cutting. No one's saying, hey, I cut this. Isn't that great?
George F. Claffey, Jr., CIO at Charter Oak State College.
But at the same time, sometimes there are things that we haven't looked at, and it's about looking at things through a new lens and saying, hey, they were able to find an efficiency by, they merged the library help desk and the IT help desk and the computer lab help desk. Well, I haven't thought of that yet. Maybe there's some efficiency I can gain out of there.
can you do some of this consortially? In the past, people have said, oh, it's too difficult. You know, we're too specialized on our campus. Well, maybe this unprecedented budget crisis is going to help us.
Teresa Bird, CIO and Director of Libraries at Ohio Wesleyan University.
I know on the library side of the house, we've been doing it with library systems for years. We participate in a consortium of five schools. We have one system. I think all across the landscape, we're looking at how can we do things differently.
I think it's causing us to think a little bit more creatively about how to do things, and it is causing us really to see that we're all part of one community, and we have to solve this together. None of us can solve this alone. We have to solve this together.
Higher ed is such a sharing environment. There's so many great listservs that are out there, and so many great conferences where people can collaborate back and forth and kind of share problems and share solutions that higher ed is uniquely positioned. The question is, can we really take advantage of it? Can we let down our guard? Can we change our regime so that it doesn't have to be that whole our first kind of mentality? And that's where I talk about, you know, sort of leaving your ego at the door. You've got to be willing to say, I need help.
One component, and I think, frankly, a beginning component, is a vision needs to be articulated. A vision can help unify and help the next steps of building the strategies that you would utilize towards fulfilling that vision. Included in that is work that I think needs to be done about values. Have a vision and strategies you understand, accept, honor your values. I think you've positioned yourself very well to have the coming conversations.
IT has to listen and listen and listen and fit the pieces together for the institution economically and effectively to help expedite that transition, because they're the tool that's going to have to be utilized to do that.
At the same time, the expectations for what IT will do and deliver and assist with continue to grow. Our students and faculty create a tremendous pressure on us to do more and more. So you have this another set of factors that are pushing the limits. And you're trying to bring this all together with a market strategy. We have to pay attention to where the business side of this, where the vendors and the market is going with cloud computing and other pieces. All of that comes together to create an extremely complex environment. There's not just one set of pressures to respond to. There are many different sets of conflicting pressures.
There are many services on campus that we can look at with a new lens. And we start asking ourselves, you know, do we need to do this? What's the reason to do this? Who's responsible for doing this?
In December, we had a whole group of projects come through, about 10 projects, and all good projects. You know, I mean, there's a need somewhere. But you kind of have to step back, and the committee, the IDBC committee, started talking about, at this point is where we are as an organization when, you know, there's an expectation we're going to have to cut funding and who knows what else. Are these things really that important today as they were yesterday? So they actually commissioned in December that we go out and look at all of our material projects that hadn't begun yet. And there were about 15 of those projects that were kind of just waiting to hit the schedule and so forth. And those 15 projects represented something like 70 or 80% of the dollars and hours out there. So we asked them to look at those projects and do a mission criticality review. And we define mission criticality as, do these projects provide, you know, significant competitive advantage for the university or avoid competitive disadvantage? Does it have a huge payback in revenue? We asked them to assess, you know, what's the return on investment for these projects? Is there direct, tangible alignment of any of these projects supporting strategic initiatives? And then finally, what's the contribution of the unit requesting the project with respect to resources? Meaning, if a project's coming forward and it's going to cost $500,000, and another project's coming forward and it's going to cost $500,000, if Unit A is willing to contribute a portion of that, then it's probably going to get a little better consideration than Project 2.
So as you weather these storms, you have to be cognizant of basic fundamental business decisions to make sure that you're making the right decisions so that the institutions you work for can remain solvent and can remain viable.
Michael William Zimmerman, CIO and Executive Director of Communications and Information Technology at Macomb Community College.
How do you balance this all out so that you're still providing the service of product that you've always done so, and yet still do it with a level of quality that the customer expects.
And I think the way that CIOs do that is by creating, you know, service level agreements back to the customers. And I think that's what's been missing in my mind in many of those cases, is that there hasn't been a real service level agreement with the department as if they were a customer. You know, it was, we'll provide you this service, but it's going to be a best effort service. We're going to get to it when we can. We're always doing you a favor. And instead of that, if we provided a reasonable service level agreement, I think that those will stand on their own two feet.
Many of us have budgets that are multi-million dollars, and we need to treat this more like a business.
Dwight Fisher, Assistant Vice President and CIO for Information Technology Services at Dalhousie University.
It's one of those rare opportunities in higher ed where you have to look at the business aspect in order to be accountable.
There are pretty significant components of how universities work that actually do overlap well with components of how corporations work. And certainly our trustees can be a significant source of that expertise, albeit needing to have that full picture of the ways in which we aren't the same as well as the ways in which we are similar. But I think we have taken advantage of that. I think we will continue to take advantage of that. I do think that there is a very significant educational piece to that as well, because part of the challenge for taking advantage of that which fits is knowing what fit means. And so really understanding what are the drivers that make that set of tools be valuable in the corporate setting, and in what part of those overlap with things that are true in our environment. So it's educating ourselves about what are the drivers for that effectiveness in the corporate world, and it's educating our corporate partners, whoever they are, in how what the drivers are in higher education.
We're intellectuals, and that's why many of us are in this business. We like that aspect of it, but when it comes to implementing technologies, especially big projects, there are dollars at stake. And if we talk and talk and talk, and we don't focus on deliverables and schedules, then there's a cost to that talk. So it really confronts the whole nature of our values.
You know, some of the things that we're probably pushing on now, things like faculty productivity, in a way nobody would be willing to talk about previously.
Albert Horvath, Vice President for Finance and Business at the Pennsylvania State University.
How many courses is a faculty member teaching? What's their research productivity? How much space are they taking up? Those kinds of conversations are not really held except in your head. And I think those are the kinds of things that are changing.
I think for a long time, we had a very solid perimeter around our IT organization. We knew where our systems were. We knew where our data lived. Our perimeter has become very fluid. Our systems are leaving our campus and outsourced or hosted solutions. Cloud computing it's going to be a huge impact on the horizon, and is a huge impact already. Our people are changing rapidly. Our skill sets are changing to manage contracts and vendors and vendor relationships as opposed to core development skills. We're rethinking everything.
The challenge that I see is, how do you keep your eye on the ball for the strategic initiatives that you really need to be doing now, that you should not defer, that you should invest in right now, because those are going to pay dividends right away in one form or another. So one thing, as an example, that we're doing in the University of Wisconsin system is we've just had a successful bid process, and we've reached agreement on a common survey software platform outsourced, at which most of the campuses in the University of Wisconsin system have agreed to participate, and we therefore have been able to lower our costs to a point where we get the economies of scale of 10 campuses buying in to a common platform. And so we not only save on the annual costs related to this, probably more importantly, we save on the basis of a common methodology and a common set of practices. Will this software work for every single discipline? I don't think it will. Our goal is for it to work for 90, maybe even 95% of the cases. But in those cases, it means that if practices are developed, we can share them among our various campuses. We can share it among schools and colleges on our own campus. We can build a body of knowledge about how to use this tool.
I do think that the merged or the integrated organization does position institutions well for the future. I think they're nimble. I think they're strategic. And they take a little time to get right. I think they have a lot of potential, but yet it's the new kid, it's the new idea. But it does have the power, I think, to be disruptive in terms of how we have done business in the past. I think as those of us who are experimenting with these organizations get it right, that they may very well serve us for the 21st century organizations that higher ed need to become.
I don't think you get many opportunities in your career to reinvent everything that you do and create an entirely new future. And I think this is one of those opportunities.
When you look at something from new eyes, you kind of wonder whose eyes are looking at them. And it's great to get innovative right now, but you can't risk losing the fundamentals that you've built up over time. And I think that's really the balance, is how do you continue to do all of the work that you need to do to support the organization, but still look ahead.
That was Michael Heitz, Associate Vice President of AITS at the University of Illinois Central Administration. If you'd like more information on how universities are coping with economic issues, visit the EDUCAUSE Economic Resource page. The link is in our show notes at www.educause.edu/now.
I'm Diana Oblinger. This weekend, I listened to John Seely Brown as our commencement speaker. He talked about innovation, collaboration, and what you need in the 21st century. And what he said was certainly relevant to the graduating seniors, but I think it's relevant to us as well. And the backdrop of his remarks is that we live in a world of accelerating change. And in that world of accelerating change, it's just not good enough to know things because the half-life of knowledge is simply too short. That what you really want to be able to do is connect with others to create new knowledge. Because if you have stored up knowledge that is perishable, it may not do you any good. It's more important to be in the flow of knowledge, in groups of people who always have information that's moving, growing, going somewhere. It's also important to realize that in a world of accelerating change, you really can't count on all the smart people being inside your organization. There will always be more smart people outside an organization than within it. And thanks to the internet, we have the opportunity to take advantage of talent that is distributed, whether it's in the center of the organization or on the edge. And since you don't know what you don't know, it's important for all of us to develop skills of deep inquiry. And where all this leads is to a concept of a creation net, something that John Seely Brown and John Hagel have written about. It involves knowledge sharing, trust relationships that are built up over time, and working to create something, whether that's knowledge, a product, or a process. And in a way, EDUCAUSE and many of the networks that we participate in are creation nets. They are certainly part of what we aspire to and how we define our value. Think about EDUCAUSE. There are smart people out there in EDUCAUSE and in places EDUCAUSE is connected to. That network is more valuable than static content. You come to EDUCAUSE activities to network, whether it's at conferences, at professional development activities, or on listservs. And the community can do more than collaborate. It can create. Think of the Teaching and Learning Challenges Project this year or the work of the Security Task Force. And those creation nets, whether in EDUCAUSE or elsewhere, actually accelerate innovation. Because you learn from others, you apply it to your own situation, then others learn from you, you learn from them, and it keeps going. So, in a world of accelerating change, position yourself in the flow of knowledge. Static content isn't enough, and that flow depends on constant inquiry. Count on the dispersed community, because talent can be found anywhere, and become part of a creation net. That's the ultimate 21st century skill. Because you create value for yourself and for others.
current economic conditions are having a significant impact on higher education, and staying up to date with resources and information can sometimes be a challenge. EDUCAUSE is here to help. Bookmark our economic downturn resource page at www.educause.edu/econ or subscribe to the RSS feed. You'll receive information on what's happening in the economy, what you can do to save money for your institution, and how you can improve the way your organization does business. EDUCAUSE, uncommon thinking for the common good.
The EDUCAUSE Learning Initiative 2009 annual meeting was a chance for educators and administrators to gather and discuss important topics related to teaching and learning with technology. I asked a few of the conference attendees to engage in a discussion on 21st century digital literacy. Our discussion includes, in order of appearance, Steve Greenlaw, professor of economics at the University of Mary Washington, Susan Mitros, deputy CIO and associate vice provost at the University of Southern California, Gardner Campbell, director of the Academy for Teaching and Learning at Baylor University, and Carl Berger, retired professor and dean emeritus at the University of Michigan. I started by asking, what processes or thinking do we need to put in place to achieve a digitally fluent university?
I think it takes leadership. It's hard to imagine, for me at least, reaching this point from a grassroots effort.
I think USC is pretty close to being a digital, at least friendly university. And it's partially because we're in LA and everybody around us is working with new media, and it's important as our students go out almost no matter what discipline that they have this experience. But some of the concrete things we've done is, first of all, we have a provost who says, who has a directive that students will learn how to be, you know, media literate. He hasn't quite told us how. He's talked about putting together a committee and asked me actually to chair this or co-chair it with a colleague of mine on a course. Now, again, whether this is the right direction or not, I'm not sure. But one of the projects they have is something called the Institute of Multimedia Literacy. And originally, they would come in and help you with your class and provide you with graduate assistants that would take the technology layer off the backs of the faculty so the faculty could teach. And they would come in and really, you know, work through the class and help the students. They found out that was too big. That was too big of a mouthful. And now they'll do it per assignment. So if I'm teaching a course anywhere in the university and I wanted one of my assignments to be a multimedia-rich assignment, I can contact this and they will take that piece of it and make it as if it's, you know, help with the assessment, with setting up the labs, you know, the grading, all those pieces of it. So I think that's a good start.
Yeah, I think that's extremely helpful. I think it's also true that the more of the work that we value in our educational institutions that we make public, that we put out there, we put the assignments that our students have done so well, put them on YouTube, put them on Flickr, have these things be published and shared, then that message comes across to the rest of the educational community as well as to the world. These things do count. These things do matter. And I think that raises the level of the conversation in the environment as well.
The other thing I think we need to do is we need to publish and not be afraid to publish our expectations and goals. There's nothing worse than to have a group of graduate students and you're really getting into developing a good piece of multimedia literate work and finding out some students really don't even have the basics. And where it puts them in a hole that they can just barely dig out is almost unconscionable for us to have put them in there by not letting them know, as you mentioned, letting them know our public expectations for them. And I think just doing that, and even if it is as brutal and as mechanical as by X, you need to know how to do pivot tables in Excel. Now that sounds horrible, and it sounds like what a trivial thing, but it is amazing how that can stop a student cold if they cannot do such a thing in, for example, engineering, business, statistics, almost any one of the basic areas where that's needed. And surprisingly enough, where it might be needed when they're doing multimedia work in design and composition, where such a device can help as well, except that they don't know that it can't, and they haven't had a chance to try it out because they don't have never used it.
And I want them to understand that these skills are also skills of citizenship as we move forward. I think we can all see what happened in the 2008 presidential campaign I want my students not only to understand that they can follow Barack Obama on Twitter, I want them to think about why this medium was chosen. I want them to understand the suite of tools available to the people who are shaping the destiny of our nation and why they would choose one and not another.
What a better way to have them figure out how to use a particular tool than to present actual questions like that, because the questions are true, meaningful questions, which forces them to gain the technology, which provides them with the ability then to understand it at a depth that's far beyond anything we can do in a basic literacy course.
But we don't practice what we preach all the time. I mean, here we are talking about how important new literacies are, and you know, we were in a session earlier where we were all excited about a print publication that might come out of a conversation. So we're still, as academics, chasing after that resume line that says print and not multimedia. Until that changes, I think it's an uphill battle.
Well, those are the real night terrors. You know, those are the things that keep me awake at night. If we really want to achieve true fluency, especially as we push away from the print paradigm, we may be talking about certain basic reorganizations of the way we think about what we do as educators. And I know that a lot of people find that very challenging. I can't say that I find it an easy thing to think about either. But if it needs to be, and if there's no other way to do it, we can't just keep patching the same old leaky tire over and over.
That's right. There has to be, literally, I believe, a paradigm shift in how we allow, encourage, and promote the study of scholarly applications of technology and content by faculty who are interested in studying these kinds of intersections, and to be able to publish them in multimedia formats that can be accepted for promotion and tenure.
Carl Berger, Gardner Campbell, Susan Mitros, and Steve Greenlaw discussing 21st century digital literacy. Be sure to look for an upcoming podcast featuring this full-length conversation from the ELI 2009 annual conference.
Thanks for joining us. If you'd like to find out more about the stories you heard, check out our show notes at www.educause.edu/now.
And let us know what you think. Drop us a line at podcast@educause.edu.
I'm Colleen Luckett for EDUCAUSE Now.
And I'm Jerry Bain. Thanks for listening.